Pradama Ki Jai, Navadvip Maya Pradama Ki Jai, Jagannath Puri Dama Ki Jai, Gangamaya Jamuna Devi Ki Jai, Bhakti Devi Ki Jai, Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai, Samaveta Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai, Gaur Premananda. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Svabhilesha Madhya Bhakti Ranta Swami Niti Namah Namaste Saraswati Deva Gauravani Pachari Nivasesa Sanyam Paskatyade Sitarane Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Guru and Vaishnavam Sucha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatam Vikam Stam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Ravita Sri Vishakam Vikam Sucha Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya. Okay, March 25th, 2009 in Auckland, and we're reading Bhagavad Gita, chapter 12, and we're starting with text 13 to 20. So first we could just read the translations out loud together. Everybody have a book? All right. One who is not envious but is a kind friend to all living entities, who does not think himself a proprietor and is free from false ego, who is equal in both happiness and distress, who is tolerant, always satisfied, self-controlled, and engaged in devotional service with determination, his mind and intelligence fixed on me, such a devotee of mine is very dear to me. He by whom no one is put into difficulty, and who is not disturbed by anyone, who is equipoised in happiness and distress, fear and anxiety, is very dear to me. A devotee who is not dependent on the ordinary course of activities, who is pure, expert, without cares, free from all pains, and not striving for some result, is very dear to me. One who neither rejoices nor grieves, who neither laments nor desires, and who renounces both auspicious and inauspicious things, such a devotee is dear to me. One who is equal to friends and enemies, who is equipoised in honor and dishonor, heat and cold, happiness and distress, fame and infamy, and who is always free from contaminating association, always silent and satisfied with anything, who doesn't care for any residence, who is fixed in knowledge, and who is engaged in devotional service, such a person is very dear to me. Those who follow this imperishable path of devotional service and who completely engage himself with faith, making me the supreme goal, are very, very dear to me. So this is one of the places in the Bhagavad Gita where there are descriptions of a transcendental person. And here specifically, a devotee. This is, of course, important. Why do we need to know the qualities or the descriptions of a person who is transcendental, or in this case, beyond transcendental, who's a devotee? Why do we need to know that?
So we can strive for it.
So we can strive for it, okay. Why else?
So we can identify one.
So we can identify one. I was just reading in Bhakti Notes, Kalyana Kalpa Taru, he says, I don't know how to recognize a devotee. On the way here, we saw a poster. A man, he's Indian, he's wearing orange, he has a long gray beard. Come to him and hear knowledge. Right? So how do we recognize a devotee? Very difficult. You may think, oh, he's got to have all these external qualifications. We're going to talk about that a little bit on Sunday, where Rupa Goswami describes how to judge who's a devotee and how not to judge who's a devotee. Don't judge on the basis of the body, he's saying. And he's making even extreme, you know, even if the body's disfigured and invalid, that's not a disqualification. That's not what's going on. What to speak of, do they have an Indian body or do they have a Korean body or do they have a Peruvian body? Or that's irrelevant. And we don't find Krishna ever discussing in these lists of qualifications what kind of body they have. In fact, he doesn't even say they have to have a human body, does he? Do we have some great devotees who are animals?
Gajendra.
Gajendra.
Yes, okay.
Hanuman?
Garuda.
Garuda? All the animals that dance for Lord Chaitanya? Yes, absolutely. Okay. Jatayu? Jatayu is a vulture. So not only an animal, but a vulture is a symbol of really nasty, right? You want to pick something, some animal body that has really nasty connotations. Even monkey, I mean, we tend to think of monkey as being cute, but that's only because we don't live with them. I read an article about people who keep monkeys as pets, and when they're babies, they're really cute, and as soon as they hit puberty, they become very violent. They'll go to the owners and pull out their teeth and rip off their faces and all sorts of really cute things like that. So people who live around monkeys, like in India or Africa, don't think they're cute. But still, you know, we have great devotees of the Lord. We're monkeys. Anyway, he's not giving any of those sort of qualifications. So yeah, we have to know, they say, that if you don't know where you're going, you probably won't get there. You have to know where you're going. You have to know what your goals are. These are some of the symptoms. We have to know how to be able to recognize a devotee, and we have to know what are we striving for. This is so important. I don't know if I've ever taught you guys what we call well-formed plan, how to have a plan that works. Well, one of the basic premises of that, of having a plan that works, is you have to have a very, very clear idea of what you're trying to achieve. And many times when we're counseling other people, and it's also true when we're working with ourselves, you know, we ask somebody, what do you want? And often they say, I don't know. Or maybe they'll just tell you what they don't want. I don't want to be angry. Well, okay, what do you want? Not to be angry. Well, but what do you want? If you can't identify what you do want, either it's just vague, or all you can identify is the absence of what you want, then it's very difficult to achieve it. You can't be, where are you going? If I just said, you know, you said I want to take a vacation. I said, where do you want to go? Well, I don't want to go to Wellington. Well, that doesn't really help me. You know, I can't help you get a ticket like that. Well, where do you want to go? There's a lot of other places on the planet besides Wellington. You know, oh, I want to go to a really beautiful place. Well, okay, you know, Tahiti, Hawaii, South Island, you know, there's lots of beautiful places. You've got to be as specific as possible. Otherwise, how do you know when you've achieved it? And also, Prabhupada often says that the main person who judges whether or not we're making advancement is ourselves. He says, just like you know when you've eaten. You don't have to ask somebody, did I eat? And unless you're diseased, you don't have to say, did I eat enough? Did I eat enough? Am I full? You naturally know when you're full. So also, we should be able to judge, how are we making advancement? By looking at these lists of qualities, which of course, the longer that I stay in Krishna consciousness, the more humbling I find these lists to be. When I was first interested in taking up Krishna consciousness, and I was reading Bhagavad Gita when I was in university, I read lists like this, and I said, oh yeah, I'm completely equipoised. That's me, Miss Equipoised. And I thought it was some sort of artificial adjustment where you walk around with a big smile on your face and just, whatever happens, it doesn't matter, it doesn't matter. Have you all tried that kind of thing? Yeah, and what happens at some point? Something matters, right? Something matters. There's a book I used to have thousands and thousands of books on raising children and teaching children. It was describing three different parenting styles. And one of them is the parent who's always yelling at the kid and always punishing the kid and always criticizing the kid. And one of them was the parent who's always mellow. You know what I mean by mellow? Oh, that's okay. I remember a mother like this. Whatever the kid would do, okay, Malini, that's all right. Whatever you want to do. Don't do that, Malini. That's not a very good thing to do. So what happens with parents like that, you can do whatever you like. let me give you a bar of candy, let me buy you a new toy, is periodically they blow up. So they'll be mellow, 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 da 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 da, and then ha! And then all of a sudden they're like Lord Nisingadev coming out of the pillar. And then they feel bad that they were so mean to their kids. And then to make up for being mean, they're da da da, and then after a while they blow up again. Now, people who are actually abusive also have a cycle like that, by the way. They call that the cycle of abuse, where, you know, somebody, they'll beat up their wife or their girlfriend, and then they feel bad, and so they're really, really nice, and then they blow up again. So artificially trying to be equipoised is something like that, where you just say, oh, yes, I don't care about heat or cold. I don't care about honor or dishonor. I don't care about friends and enemies. I'm equal to everybody. It doesn't matter. I can live anywhere. And then at a certain point, it goes beyond your tolerance. And then you become crazy. And then you feel really bad that you went crazy. And then you try to be tolerant again. So that's obviously not the real thing, is it? Right? Okay. Where else in Bhagavad Gita do we have lists like this? Now, this time Arjuna didn't ask for the list. But the other times he asks for the list. He says, how do I know? Tell me the symptoms. Chapter 2. Yes, he says, how does he sit? How does he walk? How does he speak? What is his language? Which the acharyas say refers to how is a person internally and externally. How does he sit? How does he walk? How does he speak? What is his language? How does he speak? How does he react when people speak to him? How does he stay still, and how does he work in the world? So in chapter 2, is the list very similar to this? Yeah, very, very similar. Where else? There's another place where Arjuna asks, what are the symptoms of someone who's transcended the modes of nature? So what chapter do you think that's in? It's a chapter called the modes of material nature, which is chapter 14, yes. 13 is nature, the enjoyer, and consciousness. And in chapter 14, Arjuna says, what are the symptoms? He said, how do you transcend the modes of material nature? And Krishna speaks his famous verse, Mamchayo Vyavicharina Bhakti Yogina Sevate Sagunan Samatit Chaitan Brahma Bhuyaya Kalpate. By engaging in devotional service, you conquer the modes of material nature, you transcend them. And then he gives another description. Is that description also similar to this? Yeah. Very, very similar. So we have these three places, and there may be some others here and there. There's some places in the sixth chapter also when Krishna's describing what is samadhi. But these take places in particular, chapter 2, chapter 12, and chapter 14. Now, we were talked about ourselves. Now let's talk about ascertaining somebody else. We have three authorities: Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. Guru is the person, of course, there's two main kinds of gurus. There's the Diksha Guru and the Shiksha Guru. And generally, somebody starts off being our Shiksha Guru, and then we take Diksha from them, and they continue giving us Shiksha, generally. Although it is possible for a Diksha Guru just to give you Diksha, and just to give you the instructions for how to chant your Diksha mantras, and that's all, and someone else to give you Shiksha. That is certainly possible. And you can have many, 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 many Shiksha Gurus. I was just listening to that this morning in Krishna book. How Krishna was telling to Sudama Brahmana that you can have many Shiksha Gurus. So we have gurus, and guru means somebody who I take as my authority. Generally in this material world, we don't want to have any authorities. When devotee asked Prabhupada, where is it talking about guru in the Shikshastika? He said, Trinadapi Sunichena. Because you can't become humble without submitting to authority, and you can't have a guru, really have a guru, without being humble. You can have an official guru without being humble. You can go through a ceremony and put somebody's picture on your altar, but as far as really surrender to a guru. So there's this lady who met me for a few days some time ago, and she was trying to get a hold of me, and she didn't know where I was. Anyway, she's finally gotten a hold of me, and she's told me, she said, Armila, I think that you're my guru. Okay. And then she says, I want to give you all my money for your projects. And I said, I don't want you to do that. I said, I absolutely do not want you to do that. I said, in the Shastra, it says you should keep 25% for your own needs, 25% for emergencies, and you give 50%. And that's what I want you to do. And guess what she says? Does she say, oh, yes, I will follow your instructions? She says, no, I'm not going to do that. I want to give you everything. And I'm thinking, and then she's going on and on and on about how I'm her guru, and she thinks that I'm the most wonderful person walking around on the planet, and she's just always going to be submissive to me. And I'm thinking, well, this is really funny, you know, to say, oh, I'm accepting you as my authority, but the first instruction you give me, I'm not going to follow. Out in the world, they say, I want to be more Catholic than the Pope. So she, you know, she wants to be more Krishna conscious than I'm telling her to be. Right? So this is, and I know, of course, what's going to happen if she gives me all of her money. What will happen in time? She'll really regret it. She'll become very resentful and very angry. I'm hoping at least she'll keep these emails from me and see that I told her to do something different. But I actually hope she doesn't. In fact, I'd like not to take any money from her at all. In that, I would prefer not to take even a penny from her with that mentality. So the point is that we generally don't really accept somebody as our authority. And I've spoken to so many gurus in the Hare Krishna movement who tell me that they have hardly any disciples that they can really say what they want to say to. I said that in one temple. And the temple president was very angry. He said, everybody here is totally submissive to their guru, and whatever he says, they immediately do. I said, well, did you ever ask him if he says everything that he wants to say? Maybe they follow all the instructions they're given, but maybe 99% of the instructions he wants to give, he's not actually giving. So anyway, that's one authority. And then there's sadhu. So sadhu may be as qualified as guru, but we don't have the same relationship with sadhus. It's not that necessarily with a sadhu, it's everything is yes, sir. Does that make sense? That my guru is someone who I'm accepting as my authority. The sadhu is an authority basically to see two things. How do the sadhus live the scriptures, and how do they explain the scriptures? But I'm not necessarily going to a sadhu and saying, okay, I'm accepting you as my authority in terms of practical life. So that's the difference between, because we say, well, how is there, they're different, what's the difference between guru and sadhu? And sadhus may also be, we may also look at the examples of sadhus in other traditions, and so many things that we're not accepting as gurus. We can look at, you know, St. Francis also was a sadhu. How did he live? And then finally we're looking at Shastra. Now Prabhupada says that Shastra is the center. Just reading this in Majjhalila, Chaitanya Charitamrita, Majjhalila chapter 20, I believe. Where sadhu, the Shastra is the center. The prime authority is always Shastra. Which is why I'm bringing up this whole subject of authority. And Prabhupada says that you judge who's a guru and who's a sadhu by the Shastra. If I want to buy gold, Prabhupada says, you have to first know what's gold. You have to do some study. What's gold? You know, I used to shop for the devotees in India. I used to buy stuff for like 15, 20 devotees every time I went to India. And I got to know a lot about fabric. And if you don't know a lot about fabric, you're going to be cheated. Now, they can make cloth that feels like silk and it's not. Or something that feels like cotton and it's not. Or something that feels like wool and it's not. Right? Looks like wool, feels like wool, looks like cotton, feels... But it's not, and it doesn't have the same qualities. You see, you've got to know what you're doing. You've got to know what's good quality, because you go to the shop and say, give me your best quality, and they'll say, oh, yes, 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 yes. And who knows what they're giving you? It's quite funny. And sometimes you have to say, do you have some better quality than this? You know, and they'll give you something else. And once the shopkeepers see that you're educated, then they'll give you the right stuff, generally. Once they see, I can't cheat you. You know what you're doing. But if they think, oh, this is someone who doesn't know, then they'll cheat you. So one has to study. What is a sadhu? What is a guru? And Prabhupada said, if someone's not following the Shastra, then they're not guru or sadhu. And it says, of course, the primary onus is on the prospective disciple. No, don't think that, oh, just because someone is an official ISKCON guru. No, it's our responsibility that we have to look in the Shastra and say, who has these qualifications? That's our responsibility as a prospective disciple. And it's the guru's responsibility to test the prospective disciple. But that we have to do according to the Shastra. And one may sometimes reject a guru if the guru violates Shastra. Just like Sukracharya said to Bali Maharaj, no, oh, this beggar is Vishnu, so don't give him anything. And Bali's like, wait a minute, you've been engaging me in jagyas for Vishnu all along, and now when he comes here personally, you're telling me not to give him anything. He said, you're not following the Shastra, you know, forget it. Or Bharat, Ram's brother, he rejected his mother. So sometimes one may reject also. I thought you were guru, I thought you were sadhu, but you're not following the Shastra. One thing that we should not do is partially accept, especially with guru. So I've been having this discussion with one person in ISKCON who's saying, okay, I can look at Prabhupada's purports and this part of the purport fits with the verse and goes with the Shastra and this part doesn't. This part of the purport is that was from Prabhupada's Bengali upbringing. And so I won't listen to that part of the purport. And I said, look, you know, there are some things Prabhupada said that were time, place, and circumstance that he doesn't expect you to take in an absolute manner. Quite a few, especially in letters and conversations. It's not that Srila Prabhupada expected that every single thing he says has equal weight of authority. You can't do that anyway because he sells different things at different times to different people. But I said, when Prabhupada's purporting the Shastra, then we as his disciples are expected to take his words as good as the Shastra. Otherwise, how is he our guru? I said, then I'm my own guru. Then I'm looking at the Shastra and I'm saying, well, this is what the Shastra means, and if Prabhupada agrees with my definition, he's my guru, where he doesn't, he's not. And this devotee said, well, then how do you judge who's a guru if you can't compare guru and Shastra? I said, that's before you take a guru. Before you accept a guru, you compare them to the Shastra. You compare how they're living according to the Shastra and how they're preaching according to the Shastra. And then he said, well, suppose after accepting a guru, you find they're off. I said, then you have to reject. He said, is it black and white? I said, yes. You can't say, well, I accept this thing. Again, I do want to make a distinction between when a guru is speaking on the Shastra and when they're speaking in a general way. So if a guru says to you, you know, I read in the newspaper that people who eat meat have 30% higher cancer rates, if he's saying that, and it turns out that actually it's 25% cancer rates, you know, that's that. Then the guru is not speaking from the Shastra. Do you understand what I'm saying? You don't have to go around quoting, just because your guru was quoting the newspaper and is preaching, you don't have to quote what your guru says as if it were Shastra. Okay, so please. Sometimes people do that. Sometimes people take, you know, Prabhupada was quoting some economics professor in order to make a preaching point. And they take that's the same kind of absolute statement because Prabhupada made it as when Prabhupada's preaching on the Shastra. Anyway, so this is another main reason to study these descriptions so we can tell who is a guru and who is a sadhu. And I should also mention that sometimes one may accept someone as a guru who has some difficulty, in which case one stays at a distance and accepts another, accepts a shiksha from elsewhere. Yes, side thing. Okay. Now, looking at all these descriptions, oh, I should also mention, before we get into the descriptions in detail, what are they doing in this chapter? Why are they here? I know why the descriptions are in the second chapter, because Arjuna asked. And I know why they're in the 14th chapter, because Arjuna asked. But what are they doing here? Why are they here? What was Arjuna's question in the beginning of the chapter? Yes, is it better to be a personless or an impersonless? And Krishna responded by saying that impersonalism is very difficult. And he said that devotion is very easy. And then he gave a description of the how. How do you practice devotion? Do you remember that? Do you remember that? Okay, some of the most important verses anywhere in the Shastra as far as our practical life and our preaching. Now Krishna is talking about the qualities of a devotee to also say how wonderful the personalistic path is. It's so wonderful that you develop all of these good qualities. Now, does an impersonalist also become equipoised? Yes. All right. And Krishna even said that if you want to achieve success in impersonalism, you remember? He said back at the beginning that controlling various senses, being equally disposed to everyone, such persons engage in the welfare of all. And here again, he's talking about a kind. Now, this is a little different, though. Engage in the welfare of all. And a kind friend to all living entities. Let's take a look at the Sanskrit. Maitri, friendly. Karuna, kindly. So this is really talking about an inner attitude. I not only do good for living entities, the impersonalist has to do good for all living entities, but I actually feel kindly towards them. I'm not only non-envious. There's some positive qualities. The impersonalist tends to not have negative qualities, but they have a difficult time developing the positive qualities. Now, remember we were talking about trying to develop these positive qualities through doing it artificially? I'd like to ask you something, and this is going to take a lot of introspection and a lot of honesty. What causes us to lose it? So I say I'm going to be, you know, I'm not going to rejoice or grieve. I'm not going to have friends and enemies. I'm just going to tolerate happiness and distress. I'm going to be very determined. I'm going to have all these good qualities. What causes us to abandon one of these good qualities in a situation that's too extreme for us?
Attachment.
Okay, yes. What are we attached to?
Self-enjoyment.
And therefore, why do we grab a bad quality? To defend it. Wow. You guys are so cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm attached to my own enjoyment. I'm thinking that I have to take care of my own enjoyment. And why do I give up a good quality? Because my enjoyment starts being threatened so much that I'm thinking, I better protect myself with this bad quality. I better protect myself with anger. I better protect myself with attachment. I better protect myself with lamentation, with envy. That doesn't make sense to you? No? Okay. So, you're asking me, someone's asking you to share a room with 10 other people and you don't have any space. Then the people in the room take your clothes sometimes without asking you. They spend a really, really long time in the shower and you only have 5 minutes in the shower, and when you get in there's no hot water, it's only cold. Then you're asked to go out on book distribution when it's really, really cold out and raining and you don't have any proper clothes because one of the other ladies took your clothes. And then you get angry. So you've been really peaceful and tolerant, and now you get angry. Why are you getting angry? What do you think the anger is going to do for you? You think the anger is going to protect you. You think if you get really angry, then people will start treating you the way you want to be treated. They'll start giving you more time in the shower, and they'll start giving you clothes, and maybe if you get really, really angry, maybe they'll even give you your own room. So the reason we give up good qualities is out of fear that if I keep on going with this good qualities, I'll be taken advantage of and I won't get what I want. Therefore, guess what the primary good quality is? Courage. The primary good quality is courage or fearlessness. And you know, of all of the bad qualities in the world, the only one which even the demons reject is cowardice. Even demons don't like cowardice. Demons may like lust and greed and envy, but they don't like cowardice. But that's why the non-devotees, as Prabhupada says here in one of these purports, the non-devotees are on a manovrita. They're on the chariot of the mind. And why we say that non-devotees have no good qualities. Now, all of us know people who are atheists and who have good qualities. I mean, we all know honest atheists, don't you? Of course. In fact, there are even demons who have good qualities. Of course there are. There are people who hate God, but who are charitable or who are kind, and there are many examples in the scripture like that. So why do we say that only the devotees have good qualities? Because anyone who's not in a very exalted state of purity doesn't have the courage to maintain their good qualities in all circumstances. The reason we give up our good qualities is out of cowardice. I'm afraid. I'm afraid that if I maintain this good quality, I will suffer. So how do we come, the absolute courage, where does one get absolute courage from? That I can maintain this good quality in all circumstances, no matter what. Where does that come from? Faith in Krishna. It comes from faith in Krishna. That I'm trusting that behaving this way is going to give me the grace of Krishna, and he'll take care of me, and he'll take care of me however he wants to take care of me. That is not something that can be done artificially. You can try to do it artificially, but Krishna will show you that it's artificial. He'll put you in a situation where you become a coward. And where you become so embarrassed, isn't it? At our own cowardice. But so courage is not just one of the good qualities. It is the good quality. That fearlessness, that real faith. You know, and as I say, I mean, that's how we can judge. At what point do I become a coward? I'm just remembering many, many years ago, I was in a temple where there was a conflict going on between devotees, and it was getting uglier and uglier and uglier. And at first I was trying to mediate the whole thing. And at first I was just blissful and chanting more and singing more and reading more. And I was thinking, oh, I'm so transcendental. And the conflict got hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter. And at a certain point, I collapsed. I just couldn't take it anymore. I thought, okay, this Krishna is showing me what is my limit. But yes, we start taking shelter of the bad qualities to protect ourselves. We don't have the courage to let Krishna be our protector. And you could say, well, if I just let Krishna be my protector, bad things might happen. And my response is, bad things happen anyway. I have not seen that by trying to protect myself that nothing bad happens. I don't experience it. I don't see that to the atheist that nothing bad happens. I mean, that's... And that when the real faith in Krishna is that nothing bad happens. That even the so-called bad things are not bad things. So I was just this morning listening to Prabhupada tell the story of Sudama Brahmana. So wonderful how these stories, you know them, and you hear them over and over again, but they're new stories. And how Sudama Brahmana, you know, he doesn't want to ask Krishna for anything. But his wife keeps nagging him. Go to ask Krishna. Because she loves him. It's not because she wants a big house. And finally he thinks, all right, I've got to get my wife off my case. I'll go see Krishna just so she'll stop bothering me. And anyway, I'll get a chance to go see Krishna, so that's not bad. That'll be a nice thing. I don't have to ask him for anything. I can tell my wife I went there, and, you know, my wife will be happy. I won't ask him for anything, and I'll get to see Krishna. So the whole time he's thinking about Krishna, and he gets there, and he looks like a beggar, and he's all torn, dirty clothes, and, you know, and Krishna puts him on his own bed, and Rukmini's fanning him, right? And he has this little bit of cheap rice, and Krishna eats a little bit of this cheap rice. And then Rukmini says, you know, that one morsel, that's going to cause the goddess of fortune to live in his house. Right? And he just spends time talking with Krishna about their childhood activities. And when he's leaving, he doesn't ask Krishna for anything the whole time he's there. And Krishna doesn't appear to give him anything. Doesn't give him a banana. I mean, doesn't, of course he feeds him while he's there, but he doesn't give him anything to take with him. Nothing. He's leaving as poor as he came. And the first thing he's thinking is, it's amazing that Krishna is so kind to brahmanas. He doesn't think Krishna's kind to me because I'm a great soul. He thinks Krishna was kind to me because I happen to be a brahmana, and Krishna's very kind to the brahmanas to set an example for human society. Krishna really loves the brahmanas. It's amazing how much he loves brahmanas. He doesn't take any personal credit at all for Krishna's kindness to him. And then, the point of why I'm bringing this up, is he's rejoicing that Krishna didn't give him anything. He's not thinking, oh, I went to see Krishna. He didn't give me anything. He didn't give me even one gold coin. He didn't give me a new set of clothes for my wife. Nothing. I'm going to come back to my wife empty-handed, and she's going to be so disappointed. And Krishna must have, he knew, but he didn't do anything. No. He said, my Lord is so kind that although I'm in need, he didn't give me anything because he knew that it would entangle me. And out of love for me, he didn't give me anything. How wonderful my Lord is. So he's thinking about his reception, that this is just Krishna's wonder and greatness that he's kind to the brahmanas. He doesn't think, well, I'm such a great person. And then he doesn't get anything. He thinks this is Krishna's kindness. And Krishna's such a joker. He's thinking when he eats the rice, he thought, you know, this guy doesn't want anything. He's totally detached. I think I'm going to give him a lot of opulence. Of course, the commentators say that Sudama Brahmana was very attached to being a renunciate. That he had some pride. Oh, I'm so detached. So Krishna forced him to enjoy opulence. You know, and then he comes home and all of a sudden he's on a heavenly planet practically. Even his wife had, you know, transcendental plastic surgery. She all of a sudden looks like a... The Acharya say when she first came out, she looked the same so he'd know who she was. And then she transformed into a demigod. Anyway, the point is that Sudama Brahmana, he saw something as negative as something positive. From his point of view, only good things happened. Nothing bad happened. He didn't see his poverty initially as something bad, and he didn't see the fact that Krishna didn't give him anything as something bad. So the real courage to keep these qualities is seeing that Krishna is taking care of me and everything that happens to me is good, even if, from a sense gratification point of view, it's awful. I mean, you know, really, really awful. I'm in a car accident and, you know, I have to get 20 surgeries and my kid dies in the car accident. You know, even from a material point of view, it's terrible. That, first of all, I can't protect myself, what to speak of protecting myself through bad qualities, that Krishna will take care of me and everything that he does is good. And of course, one who has this mentality inherits the kingdom of God. So that's how one gets the courage to have these good qualities in all situations. And that's why these qualities are the wonderful fruits of bhakti. And that's why Prabhupada says in one of these purports, see, the problem is the Bhagavad Gita in my room is a different one, and so things are in different places. Anyway, one of these purports. Prabhupada says that you don't develop these qualities artificially. You don't have to make a separate... I'd really like to find... It's the end of one of the purports. Okay. This is with a devotee must acquire these. Without good qualifications, one cannot be a pure devotee. Of course, he does not extraneously endeavor to acquire these qualifications, but engagement in Krishna consciousness and devotional service automatically helps him develop them. So I made this point last week, and I'm going to make it again. Automatically and extraneously endeavor doesn't mean we don't make any endeavor. And Prabhupada will often say this, but he'll often say things also like you don't have to extraneously endeavor to be a vegetarian. That when you're a devotee of Krishna, you're automatically a vegetarian. If I'm a devotee of Krishna, I can only offer Krishna vegetarian food. Therefore, I'm automatically vegetarian. But that does not mean I go to the shop and chant Hare Krishna and close my eyes and pull things off the shelf. It doesn't mean that because I chant Hare Krishna, everything I put into my mouth is automatically going to be vegetarian. I do have to make some endeavor to buy only vegetarian food or to eat only vegetarian food. But that endeavor is not outside of my Krishna consciousness. Now, what is the endeavor that we have to make to develop these qualities? Because they're coming from that faith in Krishna. That's where they're coming from. The more I have faith in Krishna, the more I'm going to actually develop these qualities in all circumstances. Without 100% faith in Krishna, there is a tipping point for all of these good qualities at which I become a coward. Again, that's why we say one who's not a devotee has no good qualities, because they don't have them absolutely. They have them up to a point. And the less faith we have in Krishna, the more these good qualities are manifested in the same way you manifest bad qualities. They manifest selfishly. I'll be equal poised when it suits me, and I'll be angry and disturbed when it suits me. So what happens as we develop faith in Krishna through the process of devotional service is we start to see. We start to become aware of. We start to realize our attachments and our fear. And then we have to make a choice to get rid of them. We don't get rid of them. Krishna gets rid of them. But we still have to make that choice. Just like if we weren't raised vegetarian, we might not have grown up looking at labels on food. Many people don't read labels on food at all. I remember once going out on Sankirtan and running into some other devotees in a car park. We were doing books in the car park, but they had been shopping. And I noticed they had some bread in their bag that they had bought. Now, it's best not to buy bread at all. But, it turned out that the bread had lard in it. And they hadn't read the label. So one has to read the label. And reading the label, that's Krishna in your heart saying, right now what you're doing has lard in it. You're doing something that's envious, or you're doing something that's attached. You're attached to a residence, or you're envious of another living entity. You're lamenting for something in the material world. Does that make sense? And then we can reject it. Then we can say, Krishna, I don't want to lament for anything in the material world. I just want to work for you. So there's still choice on our part. It's not automatic in the sense that we're not making any kind of choice, that it's just put on us. All right, I want to look at just a few of these individually. As a rule, most of them are about being equal poised. Okay, a kind friend to all living entities and not envious. So one can only be a kind friend to all other living entities if we know that we're not the body. Otherwise, I'm going to distinguish. Here's a cockroach, I don't like them. Here's a kitten, I like it. When I was in university, some students were giving a presentation, maybe three of them, and one of the women there said, "Oh, there's a spider!" And she stamps on it. And then she says, "Not anymore." I thought, whoa. And nobody else thought anything of it. I'm in the class just shocked. Wow. Non-devotees really do things like that, don't they? But as soon as you think that I'm this body, then, you love your dog and you step on the spider. I love one person and I hate another person. I can't be a kind friend to anyone, to everyone. And I'm certainly envious. If somebody else has something nice, I want it. And envy, how can I really be kind if I'm envious? Envy means there's some enmity. I want something of yours. Okay, first we'll just look at there's two levels of quality. One is essential, one is what we call marginal. So first we'll just look at all the marginal. Tolerant, always satisfied, self-controlled. I'm not controlled by somebody else. It's not that somebody else has a stick over me. I'm controlling myself. If you need somebody with a stick over you, then you're a Shudra. The lowest class of persons, they don't even do any work unless somebody's watching. You know, as soon as the boss goes out of the room, then they're playing games on the internet or something, right? So that's Shudra. So self-controlled. I really like this one in text 15. He for whom no one is put into difficulty and who is not disturbed by anyone. And again, we have equipoise and happiness and distress. So not putting anybody else into difficulty. Not causing disturbance for anybody. Of course, in this world, other people are going to be disturbed by some things we do no matter what. But at least never intentionally putting anyone else into difficulty. Trying to live with a light footprint, you could say. And not taking from others, and not being disturbed by the behavior of others. When devotee called me yesterday, said, I told my husband a way we could refinance our house and save $350 a month, and he wouldn't even look at the papers. And I'm so angry. He wouldn't even consider it, and now the rate's gone up, and we lost the opportunity, and we're just wasting Krishna's money, and it's really terrible, and I'm really angry. And I said, who's wasting Krishna's money, you or him? He is. I said, are you wasting Krishna's money? And why are you so angry at him? He said, well, it's our money together. I said, but who's in charge of the money in your household? He said, he's earning all the money. He's in charge of the money. That's his responsibility. I said, did you do your responsibility? I said, do you take care of how you spend money? Well, yeah. I said, did you bring up this to him and let him know that he had this opportunity? Yeah. I said, so why are you so disturbed? I said, does Krishna not give you enough money? Are you need money? She said, no, I have enough money. I said, you have some big preaching project in mind for which you need a lot of money? She said, no, I have no idea what I would do with the extra money. I had asked like 20 times. I said, do you need money? Is Krishna not giving you enough money? No, Krishna's giving me plenty of money. Krishna's giving me plenty of money. I said, what is the problem? Why are you so disturbed by others? But he's wasting money. I said, that's his problem. I said, that's between him and Krishna. That's not your problem. So we often get very disturbed by others. I mean, you know, what to speak of if they're doing something directly to us, like using all the hot water in the shower, or we have a little heater in our bathroom, but it just turns on at 2:30 in the morning. It's not on all night. So you have to remember, if you use the bathroom at night, to leave the door closed. Because if the door is open and the heater's on, it doesn't do any good. Now, if the heater's on at night, you remember. But because it's off at night, well, you might not remember. Say, go take a shower this morning, the heater was on and the door was open. And I'm thinking, yeah, you know. The person who shares the bathroom with me is a Maori, and she's real hardy, you know. She's real hardy, New Zealand stuck. She's much more tolerant of heat and cold than I am. You know, whatever, whether it's someone doing something to us. And I'm like, okay, Krishna, thank you for giving me the opportunity to do some real austerity for you this morning. Or somebody, you know, takes your shoes, or they yell at you or whatever. I had to speak of something that, you know, something else, not being disturbed by others. Not disturbing others and not being disturbed by others. You can see where that comes down to faith in Krishna, doesn't it? I kept asking this girl, is Krishna taking care of you? 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 Do you have enough money? Said, can you buy what you need? She said, well, there's other things I'd buy if I had more money. I said, yes, that's fine, but, you know, do you have what you need? Do you have what you need? Do you have some desire that for which you need? I said, I kept asking her also, do you have any desire for which you need a lot of money that you don't have? She said, no. I said, well, we could use it for preaching. I said, what preaching project do you have in mind?
I don't know.
I said, well, maybe you should get a preaching project in mind, and then Krishna will give you the money for it. You know, so this is, it's lack of faith in Krishna. And, you know, I'm so angry with my husband. Not giving up this equipoise, thinking, yeah. All right. Yes.
Difficult place in terms of
that Krishna will take care of me. So I asked her, are you doing your duty? You understand? I asked her, are you doing your duty? Yes. If I'm doing my duty, then Krishna will take care of me. Why should I get angry at somebody else? Now, if her duty was to be in charge of him, that's something different. Because she said to me, oh, but, you know, when you were doing this with your project and so-and-so did this with the money, you got very angry. I said, yeah, that's because I was the one in charge. And I was responsible. I said, that's a whole different thing. I said, I was running the project and this person took out a credit card in the name of the project and ran up a $5,000 debt without telling me. Cute, huh? So, yeah, then I was angry. That was a whole different thing. Now, that was my duty. I said, I'm sorry, you can't do that. You can't just go taking out a credit card in the name of the project and spending the project's money without authorization. Sorry, you know, you've got to pay this back and close this out. So that was my duty. But if I have somebody over me who's doing something, again, I might make a choice to leave. I might make a choice to report them to a higher authority. If my authority's, you know, if it's really bad, if my authority's taking Krishna's money and spending it on, you know, nightclubs, I might report them to their authority. And at a certain point, I might say, you know, I can't work under this authority. They're violating Shastra. But if it's not violating Shastra, if it's just my opinion that my authority could spend the money more wisely, then I do my duty. Krishna will take care. Why should I be angry? Why should I be disturbed by others? That means I don't think Krishna will take care of me. I think I have to take care of myself by becoming angry. And if I get really, really angry, then the person will consult with me next time and do what I say. And I said, what else could you have done? And she said, I could have demanded that he refinance the house. I said, then, you know, you're the boss. Right? Except that's not your duty. You're not the boss. These things are hard to do. They cannot be done artificially. I'm not saying these are easy. I'm not saying I do them all the time. I have my tipping point of cowardice also. Okay? You can't just do it artificially. I mean, to some extent, we all do it artificially just to be civilized people. Everybody does that. Everybody acts like they have good qualities artificially just to get along with other people and have friends. But that's different than having it really deep inside. I'm behaving like I'm not disturbed, and actually inside I want to punch you in the nose. You know, that's not having the quality. Equal to friends and enemies. Whoa. This is also, of course, mentioned in the sixth chapter. Who's a friend? A friend is someone who does things pleasing to me. Who's an enemy? An enemy who does things that are displeasing to me. That's how I define friends and enemies. This person interferes with my idea of happiness, and this person helps my idea of happiness. Even we might say, this person helps me in my Krishna consciousness, and this person hurts me in my Krishna consciousness. But we don't hate anybody. Some people we should stay away from. Being equiposed to friends and enemies and loving all living entities doesn't mean I keep a monkey in my house to bite my face off and pull out my teeth. Doesn't mean I go live in a cage with the tiger at the zoo. But I don't think of anybody as my enemy. And if someone acts as my enemy, I think this is Krishna helping me. Just like Sudama thought, Krishna's helping me by keeping me poor. And he was really poor. He wasn't just a little poor. He was really poor. Again, we have happiness and distress. Krishna keeps saying it's happiness and distress. Heat and cold. Honor and dishonor. That's really hard. Isn't it? Even Krishna doesn't like being dishonored. When Krishna was dishonored, he went into the forest to find the Shamantaka jewel. We're not saying that you have to look at dishonor or enemies and say, oh, I love it. But you see, you know, everything is for my benefit. This is also for my benefit. This is ultimately Krishna working for my benefit. Ultimately, it is something good. And whatever Krishna wants to give me, okay. Now, we have, as preachers, it is very important. Actually, it's one of the principles that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught. It's very important as preachers that we don't do anything dishonorable. He says a black spot on a white cloth is very visible. And we are presenting ourselves as representatives of God. As soon as we wear a tilak and neck beads, we're saying, I represent God. So we should not do anything dishonorable. And something that's even more difficult than that is not to even appear to do anything dishonorable. Not to do anything that somebody might think is dishonorable. So, for example, you shouldn't be alone in a room with the door closed with a man who's not your, you know, husband, father, son. Nobody should be able to say, oh, what were you doing in that room alone for half an hour? Oh, we were just talking about business. No, the door should be open. It should be a public place. No one should be able to question where you have no defense. You know, you disappear for a few days. Nobody knows where you are, what you're doing. Prabhupada says Caesar's wife should be above suspicion. And if in spite of our never doing anything dishonorable, people still dishonor us, then we tolerate. This must be Krishna. And some people will dishonor us no matter what. People dishonor Krishna even, what to speak of anyone else. One devotee recently said how she has all these very, very high academic qualifications, and she was working with some devotees in a project for which she's probably the most qualified devotee on the planet. But they weren't paying any attention to her opinion. And I said, you know, people don't even listen to Krishna when he talks about spiritual life. So why would you know? So, and certainly he's the most qualified person. So don't be so surprised. Sometimes we may be dishonored. Again, but this sort of detachment doesn't mean, well, I don't care if I'm honored or dishonored, so I'll just do anything. I don't care what anybody thinks of me. And it is the materialistic people want to maintain their reputation so people will give them respect and people will treat them nicely and they'll get sense gratification. But we should be very, very attached to having a good reputation. Unless we're living as avadutas. I mean, unless we're not preachers. And we're all supposed to be preachers. So there you have it. We should try to be very, very careful that we both are clean and we look clean. You understand? That our life is clean and our life looks clean. That people cannot find some reason to criticize. Again, people can criticize anyway, you know. You can be the cleanest person on the planet and they may criticize. What to do? Then you can just think about how Krishna is also criticized, Jesus was criticized, Haridas Thakur was criticized, Prabhupada was criticized by his own godbrothers. It's the way of the world. If you are working in a prison and you're preaching that you should be a good citizen, the other prisoners are going to make fun of you. Well, it can't be done. Silent, of course, means talking about Krishna. And we were reading last Sunday from the Nectar of Instruction. Rupa Goswami says, don't do prajalpa. And again, I'm just going to really suggest that you read Bhaktivinoda Thakura's Bhaktiloka when he talks about what is prajalpa and what is proper discussion. He keeps saying there about not talking about others. Very interesting discussion he has in Bhaktiloka about not talking about others. Who doesn't care for any residents? This is really a problem for women. Why? Why do women tend to be attached to a particular residence? To having a residence and a particular residence? Yeah, well, especially to protect our young, our children. Because we're the ones who give birth. So even if we don't have children, it's part of our psychology. It's a necessary part of our psychological makeup. It's very much tied to our biology. Because we're the ones who have children, we naturally want the children to have a safe place. So a woman is very much wants to have a home, wants to have some place that's hers and she has some control over for the protection of her children. So if you see it like that, it's a lot easier to have some detachment for it. You see it. See that that general tendency of a woman to be attached to having money, to be attached to having a home, nice food, all these sorts of things, that they're because it's our duty to protect the child. And a man, of course, a man, if he wants to enjoy this world, has to be in touch with a woman. And as soon as he's in touch with a woman, then she's the one who pushes him to get all these things, generally speaking. She's the one who's saying, you know, okay, I want a place to sit, and I want a nice kitchen, and I want this, and I want that. But that's where it's coming from. I mean, that's at least helped me now that my children are grown, and I don't have that biological necessity anymore to get some detachment from these sort of things. That I see that tendency that's in my body is not needed anymore. That it had some function in Krishna's service for practical life, and now it doesn't have any more function. And that way I'm much more able to deal with it. But it is a very strong thing in a woman's psychology. We should at least see that I'm doing this out of service and out of necessity, and not again out of fear. This is practical, you're not this body. To see that this body has certain inclinations which are necessary and good and helpful, but I'm not this body. And therefore I can control to what extent and how I use the natural attachments of this body. I don't have to be controlled by them. Does that make some sense? All right, then we have the main qualities, which is explained mostly in text 20, which Krishna starts with yay tu. Tu means but. So over and above all these marginal qualities, the main thing is someone who follows this path, dharma amrita. Dharma amrita. So amrita means nectar, and Prabhupada translates it as imperishable path. Doesn't die. Mrita means death. Amrita means imperishable, full of life, eternal, or something that's nectar. Right? With faith, shraddha. So again, we're talking about how all these good qualities come from faith. Faith is not something that you can do artificially. It's something that grows with experience, which is one of the main reasons that this is a gradual process. Faith grows with experience. And it goes with properly interpreted experience. Sudama Brahmana could have left Dwarka and said, all my faith in Krishna was misplaced. I don't know why I went to see him. What is the use of worshiping him? I'm leaving as poor as I came. Right? Could he have thought that? Could he have just been angry and said, forget all this religion stuff? If I want money, I'm not going to ask Krishna. I'm just going to go out and get a job. His faith in Krishna increased when Krishna didn't give him anything. He had more love for Krishna. He had more faith for Krishna. So faith increases from properly interpreted experience. So with faith, shraddha mat param, taking me as everything, that Krishna is the one who's going to be my shelter. And the more I do that, the more I see that it works and the more I have faith. And of course, Krishna has also referred to this prime quality in 13 through 14. Mind and intelligence fixed on me. Remember, we keep saying over and over again, that's the essence of Krishna consciousness. To always think about Krishna. Everything that we're doing is to bring us to the point of always thinking about Krishna. All right, this ends our 6 middle chapters of the Bhagavad Gita, which deal mostly with the nature of God and the nature of devotional service. And then we're going to start next week on chapter 13, which is describing material nature. The Vedic scriptures give a much more detailed description of the soul and of the nature of the work, which is the first 6 chapters, than most other scriptures of the world. They have a much greater detailed description of God and the process of loving God than other scriptures of the world. And they give a greater description of material nature. What is this world made out of? How does it work? So the last six chapters deal with the modes of nature, reincarnation. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else here that any other particular? I didn't talk about each one of them. Is there anything you want to ask on what I talked about or any of these qualities that we didn't get into a discussion about? Yes. Fear with its what? Fear with its prayers said. Yes. Well, that's why Vedic society has Brahmachari Grihastha Vanaprastha Sannyas. So Brahmachari training is, to some extent, training in faith. Of course, the typical Brahmachari is a child. Typical Brahmachari means 5 to 10 or 5 to 12, not older than 10 or 12. And you're living away from your mommy and daddy. You know, you're a little child and you're living away from home with your guru. And maybe at home you're a prince, because Brahmachari life was for the Brahmin, Kshatriyas, and Vaishya children. Maybe your parents are very wealthy. Maybe they're very learned. And here you are, just one of the kids. And you go out begging every day. That's hard. You little kid, and you go from door to door begging. That takes a lot of faith. And then you give everything to your guru. You don't keep anything that you begged. And you have faith that my guru is going to take care of me. And you perform austerities. You sleep on the floor with just a little blanket. You bathe with cold water. You don't have a whole lot of toys to play with. And that's some training in faith. And then as a householder, your faith is that if I earn an honest living and give in charity, that I'll be taken care of. Because the tendency of a householder is to want to do things illegally and hoard their own money. So that's also a risk. And in Kali Yuga, it's a huge risk. To work an honest livelihood and give money in charity? Whoa. And think you're going to survive? And we see a lot of devotees in the Hare Krishna movement are not doing that. I know a lot of devotees who don't earn money in an honest way. Many, 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 many. What to speak of giving in charity? What to speak of giving 50%? I don't know very many people who do that. That takes a lot of faith. That's a risky thing to do. By the way, giving 50% doesn't necessarily mean you have to give it to somebody else. You can also use 50% of your money yourself to do your own preaching project. I mean, it's not necessarily it has to be managed by somebody other than you. But that takes a lot of faith. That's definitely risky. And then vanaprastha, you leave your house. That's risky. Where am I going to stay? You know? Stay in the forest and just pick berries. It's kind of hard to do that in New Zealand. You could do that in Hawaii. Hawaii, I could be a real vanaprastha. Live on the avocados. It wouldn't be very austere. It'd be pretty opulent. There's one place we drive by there that sells smoothies. You know what they are? And the place is surrounded by fruit trees. They go out and pick their own fruit. Amazing. All around it, you know, there's pineapple bushes and banana trees and avocado trees and mango trees and papaya trees and. They say we make our own smoothies from our fruit in our backyard. Anyway, that's a vanaprastha. And the sannyas, Prabhupada says, no one should take sannyas until they're 100% fearless. If you're not fearless, you don't even take sannyas. And going through those stages is supposed to prepare you for that. Fearlessness is, I'll go anywhere. The traditional sannyasi traveled on foot, often alone, like Madhavendra traveled alone. And they went through real jungles. You know, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu went through real jungles with real lions and tigers. And again, you don't know where you're going to stay. You don't know how you're going to eat. So, and we're all supposed to be preachers. That's pretty risky. Don't you go out and distribute books? Is that what you wanted to do when you were a little girl growing up? No. It's risky. Isn't it? I was just thinking, as I think often when I come here, you know, about Devan Ritchaswami coming here and starting this. How do you start something like this? I mean, you can think of how you maintain it, which is hard enough, but how do you start it? How do you do that? How do you get enough people, enough money to rent the place in the first place and advertise it and nobody knows about it and you're taking a risk, isn't it? And I was especially thinking about it today because he's coming this afternoon. I was seeing his picture there and I was just thinking, you know, it's a big risk. How do you do that? Go to some country where something isn't, you know, some place where something isn't going on and you start something from scratch. Suppose you fail, and you might fail. And sometimes you do fail. Oh, yeah. Don't you take risks in your service? You want to develop the faith now. Be careful what you want. Be careful. But go at Krishna's timetable is better. What? And I'm sure I've said this to you guys before. If you ask for surrender that you're not really ready for, Krishna will show you you're not ready for it, and it's not a pleasant experience. It really isn't. Basically, you'll say, and I think almost everybody I've met tried this at least once. Most of us tried it two or three times. Where you say to Krishna, all right, I want total faith. I want total surrender. And he takes one of your attachments and he just shakes it a little bit. He doesn't even take it away. Just shakes it. And you go, ah, forget it. And then maybe a couple months later you try it again. You know, and you, ah. But yeah, you should reach a point where you can ask that. But you should, you know, by the time you reach that point, you'll know what you're asking for and you'll be able to ask for it honestly. That's the point where you can look at, okay, Krishna, whatever it takes, I'm willing to take it. And you really know what that means. I mean, just like this woman writing me that she's totally surrendered to me. I'm totally surrendered to you. Okay, keep half the money for yourself. No, because I'm so surrendered to you. Okay. So from her perspective, oh, and she's 27, and I said, so do you have a family? No. I said, well, do you, you know, plan to get married? No, I never want to get married. And I'm thinking, oh, okay. She says, I have no material desires. Maybe she has no material desires. I don't know. Maybe she's a pure devotee already. So from her perspective, and, you know, I went through that too, so I can't say anything about her. So from her perspective, is she fully surrendered? Yeah. She's thinking, I'm fully surrendered. I'm ready to, I want 100% faith now. And I'm looking at this and saying, this is funny. I'm willing to do whatever you say. Okay, do this. No. I'm too surrendered to do that. I'm more surrendered than your instructions. All right, Krishna. So, you know, how do we learn? We learn by being like that and saying I want everything now. I'm just thinking as a teacher I would, I might have told you guys this before, as a teacher I would sometimes get kids who had gotten behind in school and other places. Maybe their parents moved a lot or they went to lousy school, something, and they'd come to me 2, 3, sometimes 4 and 5 years behind academically. So I would give them a diagnostic test, and often the children, and especially the parents, would say, we want our child to get caught up immediately. So if it was just coming from the parents, I wouldn't take it so seriously. But sometimes it would be coming from the kids. I want to get caught up, especially they see on their test where they are. Most of those kids wouldn't be willing to do what was required. I'd say, okay, we'll put you on a double program. You don't have to do all the work, but you'll do the most essential work and you go at double speed. It's not necessarily that you have more work, but you're going almost too fast to digest what you're learning. I had a sadistics professor. It really was sadistics, who taught like that. He would teach us 5 new concepts per class. And as soon as you thought you were just barely maybe getting it, he'd go on to another concept. You never had a chance to practice the first concept. And then you'd come home with 5 new concepts to practice. And it was a 4-hour class, and it took you an hour each way to get to school, so that was 6 hours already. The day was gone. And then you had to spend 2 hours preparing for tomorrow's class, so you didn't even understand what he said. And how much time did that leave you to practice the new material? And it was going so fast that, you know, you could barely hold on to anything. So if kids wanted an accelerated program, I had to do something like that, where you had to learn new material so fast that you could hardly really assimilate the old material first. And most kids, after 2 or 3 weeks of that, they'd say, I can't handle this. I have to go at a slower pace, even if it means I'll graduate a year later. But some people were willing to do it. I had one boy who made 5 years of progress in 2 years. And he really did it. I mean, he really, really did it. He was just Mr. Determination. And he said, I'm going to do this. And every day after school, he would sit down and he would do his homework till it was done, and he would not play with the other boys or do anything else until it was done. He was just, I'm going to do this. And he did it. So we will get to a point in our Krishna consciousness where we'll say, you know, I'm just going to do this. I'm going to surrender to Krishna enough already. But will you really mean it? And you really, and he says, all right, you know, you want to go on an accelerated program. And you say yes, and you mean it. Whatever that means. And you're willing to trust whatever it means. And you say, you know, Lord, I'm a little scared, but okay, I'm going to trust you anyway. Don't hurt me too much, okay? Don't make it too hard. So when you're ready to say that, when you're ready to look at anything he could throw at you, all this stuff here, enemies, dishonor, poverty, no residence, no health, that even if it means that, I'm still ready to go for the ride. If that's what I have to do, then I'll do it. When you're ready to say that and mean it, well, you don't feel like, oh, no. All right? We'll get to that point. We will get to that point. And we say, I don't care what I have to pay for this. I don't care what the price is. That's greed. Like materially, that's what greed is materially, isn't it? I'm going to cheat people. I'm going to break the law. I don't care as long as I get money. I don't care what the consequences are. I don't care if I get caught and go to jail and my name is all in the headlines of the newspaper, the biggest cheater of the century. I don't care. I just want money now. That's greed. So that's what it means to be greedy for Krishna. Whatever, I don't care what the price is. My family can reject me. I can lose all my money. I can lose my health. I can lose my honor. I can lose my place in society. I can be a homeless bum on the street. Doesn't matter. If that's what I have to do to get Krishna, I'll do whatever he wants me to do. I'll do it. You cannot do that artificially. You just can't. The cowardice will kick in and you'll say, no, I can't do this anymore. I don't trust anymore. All right? All right? And, you know, he's a good teacher. He knows what he's doing. He knows what the timetable is. He knows what we have to assimilate before we can go on to the next thing. But, yeah, get out of your comfort zone. Definitely. I draw the 3 circles. Comfort, stretch, and panic. So don't stay in the comfort zone, but don't panic either. You don't want to say, I can't take this spiritual life anymore. It's too much for me. The devotees who do all these qualities, they're just floating in transcendental bliss. They don't care what's happening with their body or their situation. It doesn't matter to them. It's not them. All right? Anything else? Yes. I don't know. Different for different people. Some people, it's bahunam janmanam ante. Some of us, it may be many, 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 many lifetimes. That's individual. Right? I'm thinking also, I always wondered as a student, and again as a teacher, why grammar is taught for so many years. We start teaching grammar when a kid is about 7 or 8, certainly by the age of 8. And we're still teaching it at 16 or 17. And some of the things you're teaching are, you know, what is a noun? What is a verb? Having agreement between subject and verb. We're still teaching that at age 16. And a lot of people don't get it. I see a lot of adult writing, and people's grammar is not what it should be. Why? Why are we teaching the same thing over and over and over and over again for all those years? 8 years, 10 years, 12 years, and people still don't learn it. It always bothered me. It bothered me that my teachers taught me over and over again. I thought, I get it already. Leave me alone. And it bothered me as a teacher. It's funny, as a kid, I just like, do you think I'm stupid or you're a bad teacher? Why are you teaching me the same thing over and over again? I already understood it the first time. And as a teacher, I said, oh, that's why they teach it over and over again, because nobody gets it. I remember this one girl, Sachi Sarma. At age 12, she didn't say anything to me, but she obviously made a decision. I'm going to get this over with. I'm going to learn this. And that year she learned it. I never had to put her through a grammar course again. She did it. She said, you know, enough of this. Nouns and verbs and adverbs and adjectives and gerunds and participles and indirect clauses and direct clauses and phrases. I'm tired of it. And she applied herself. That was it. So when does that happen? You know, that's, I don't know. You're going to do it when you're 8 years old? You're going to do it when you're 12 years old? You're going to do it when you're 16 years old? You're going to do it when you're 40 years old? I don't. It's very different for different people. Why? Did you get to a point you just say, you know, okay, let's do it now. Let's go. But you think, you know, you have to have some faith. You have to have a real desire for the goal, a real faith that the goal is worth achieving. If I think something's worth achieving, then I'm willing to pay any price for it, is basically what it comes down to. I have to have faith that Krishna is benevolent. That he's not going to hurt me. That even his so-called hurting of me is not hurting of me, that it's kindness. No, that. You want to know how to speed up the process? Is that the essential question? You know the answer to that. Do things with attention. Whatever you're doing, do it with attention. Especially chanting. But everything you're doing, be mindful. What's Krishna repeating in the Bhagavad Gita over and over and over again? Think of me, think of me. Think of me, think of me. Just reading Prabhupada saying this, how the demons get salvation. Why? Because they're just thinking about Lord Vishnu. Even if they're thinking about him as an enemy, the point is to think about Lord Vishnu. Rupa Goswami says the whole essence is to always remember Krishna. Be mindful. Don't do things robotically. If you find yourself doing things robotically, pull your mind back again, like he says in the sixth chapter. Pull your mind back again, and it'll be your mind to wander, and don't be impatient. Be patient. Keep attempting to think of Krishna as much as possible. Fill your mind with Krishna. Fill your mind with Krishna's pastimes. Fill your mind with Krishna's name. Everything you're doing, Prabhupada wrote to your Guru Maharaj. He wrote this wonderful letter about surrender is that whatever I'm given to do, no matter what it is, I do it with full attention to every detail. I try to do it as first class as possible. You know, whether it's cleaning the toilet or making porridge or distributing a book or teaching a yoga class or hoovering the rug or whatever it is, I'm thinking I'm doing this for a person. I'm doing this for my Guru. You're so fortunate. You know, your Guru is coming tonight. And you can think, I'm hoovering the rug for him. That's not a difficult thing to do. You know, I'm doing this to please Krishna. He's a person. Like you're cooking, and you're cooking because some guest is coming, and you're thinking about you want the guest to be pleased, and you want them to eat a lot, and you want them to be happy with what you're cooking. And you think, I'm cooking for Krishna. So be mindful. Be attentive. Basically, what you want to do is get close to Krishna. You want to get as close to Krishna as you possibly can. And then what does Prabhupada say? Krishna is light, Maya is darkness. Where there's Krishna, there's no darkness. As I come to Krishna, everything becomes clear. The goal becomes clear. The process becomes clear. My choices become very, very clear. What did Krishna say? He said that, as I was saying, these such important verses. What is the purpose of Abhyas Yoga? To develop? Talked about this last week. To develop? Practice yoga, sadhana bhakti. What is the whole purpose? What does Krishna say is the purpose of sadhana bhakti? Desire. To develop desire. For Krishna. To develop a desire for Krishna. So as I'm practicing, thinking about Krishna, thinking about Krishna, thinking about Krishna. Like this morning I was hearing the story of Sudama Brahmana. And I was seeing how funny Krishna is. He's funny. He could have said to Sudama in Dwarka, hey, you're going to have a pretty nice surprise when you get home. He could have said that. He didn't. He didn't say anything. He didn't talk about, you know, I think I'd like to help you out. He didn't say anything. He let Sudama leave thinking he had gotten nothing. And then to come back and be surprised. Don't we like to do that? Have a surprise party? Somebody's birthday and they think everybody's forgotten their birthday and nobody says anything to them and the whole day is going by and nobody says a word and they're just like, you know, oh man, they all forgot my birthday. And then there's a surprise party. It's fun. And I was thinking how loving Krishna is. That he thought, oh, this Sudama Brahmana, he loves me so much. You know, I think I'm going to give him more opulence than I give Indra. And how much fun he was. And then you start thinking, I'd like to see him. Not, I'd like to see him because I'm tired of suffering in the material world and I'd like liberation, or I'd like to see him because to fulfill all of my desires, or I'd like to see him because I'm curious. But I'd like to see him because he sounds like a really nice person. Sounds like somebody I'd like to have as a friend. So one starts developing ichcha. One starts developing a desire. And the more I desire to be with Krishna, and the more I think how wonderful he is, then the more I don't really care what price I have to pay. Again, people do this materially. Some boy and girl fall in love with each other, and the girl doesn't care. Her relatives say, you know, he's a bad boy. He rides a motorcycle, you know. He's got all these tattoos. She says, I don't care, I love him. And her friends say, I don't know, you know, I don't think he's going to be very good for you. And she just gets on the back of his motorcycle and rides off into the sunset. Right? She doesn't care. She doesn't care that her parents and her society and everybody say that he's bad. And maybe he really is bad even. And she doesn't even care. He has no money. You know, all he has is a motorcycle. So that we get to the point that we love Krishna so much, we don't care. Society thinks we're crazy. We don't care. He may take away everything we have. That's all right. We don't care. That Krishna, he's tricky. He takes everything away. Oh, that's all right. Whatever he does, I don't care. So you have to love him that much. And then you have to see Maya for what it is. So as we get close to Krishna, we see Krishna for what he is, and we start thinking, oh, he's really nice. And then we see Maya for what it is. We start saying, whoa, I'm not really a very nice person. I'm full of all this. Ugh. I don't like who I become. I don't like the way I'm living. As Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, I don't like material life very much. That doesn't mean, you know, I'm tired of suffering in the world. It means I don't like this mentality of being separate from Krishna. I don't like this mentality of just thinking about my own happiness. It's nasty. And that's really what we're giving up. We're not really giving up, you know, money or health or friends or honor. We're really giving up a selfish mentality. So get as close to Krishna as you can. And when he shows you these things, look at them. When he shows you how nice he is, meditate on it. When he shows you how nasty material life is, accept it. No, I'm not that bad. It's not that bad. No. So it's slow because we either do things robotically or we don't do them. Niyamagraha. Either you don't do something or you just do it externally. Or after doing things mindfully, we move away from truth. I don't want to see the truth. I don't want to see how nice Krishna is. There's different ways of doing things robotically. You can fill your mind with thoughts of how to politically change ISKCON or something like that instead of Krishna. So if you do that, things will go very fast. It's hard to do that, by the way. It's hard to do that. It's hard to do that because our minds are full of so many things other than Krishna that we're attached to. And I don't want to pull my mind to Krishna. I want to think about all these other things. And it's hard because when I get close to Krishna, not only do I see how wonderful he is, but I also see Maya. And because I'm in Maya, it's not so pleasing. At least at first. As Ravindra Prabhu said, that at first it's very distasteful and then it becomes delightful. Right? Is that okay? And then some patience and trust Krishna. How long it's going to take. If we're doing that, then how long it takes is his business. Then he's taking us as we can go in such a way that we will neither be, you know, just comfortable nor panicked. He's not going to take us so fast that we panic. He's just not going to do that. He cares about us. So then it's also a little bit of trust. You know, why can't I study that? Why can't I study the Algebra 2 book? Because you haven't really learned how to do equivalent fractions yet. Let's do that today. And that takes also some trust. That maybe there's some things I have to do first that I may not be even admitting. You know, I already think that I know calculus. You know, I want to be in the calculus book with the big kids. And he's saying, well, you know, your subtraction with borrowing isn't quite down yet. I think we need to do that today. So that's also trust. Don't get impatient. And Krishna will give you some breaks too. Every good school has vacations. When he does that, just be happy. Don't demand to go to school 365 days a year. He'll give you breaks. He'll give you times when it's just light and easy and blissful. There's no big lessons and there's no big struggle. And just say thank you. Okay? He does that too. Don't be impatient on the vacation times. You know, when you're working on something and your brain starts fizzling, right? You're studying and after a while you're not even reading the words anymore because you're tired. You say, but I'm supposed to finish now. Sometimes it's good. So Krishna will give you times of just sweetness. Just sweetness. And Krishna consciousness is just sweet, and you're just happy, and you're not seeing any anarthas, and there's no struggle, and everything's just... And then you can think, oh, I guess now I'm advanced. And he says, no, this is a rest area on the side of the road. So you can breathe for a little bit. I'll say, okay, let's get back to work. So be happy for the work times, and be happy for the... Whatever he gives you, be happy. Whatever you're going through, take it. This is his mercy. If he gives me something nice, that's his mercy. He gives me a beautiful new sari, that's his mercy. My beautiful new sari. I'm just remembering when I came back from a trip to India and I had all these nice new saris. And one of them I wore for the first time when we went out shopping. And there was a bottle of bleach in the bag I was carrying. So I wore that new sari once. So, you know, whether he gives you a beautiful new sari, whether he has you spill bleach over your beautiful new sari. Both are his kindness. That's another way to make things very fast. See everything as Krishna's mercy. Don't hate the suffering, but don't hate the little pleasures he gives you too. Gives you some nice prasadam to eat that's tasty. Be grateful. You know, when Sudama got his house, he was also grateful. It's like, wow, what a nice friend I have. So when he thought Krishna was going to give him nothing, he said, what a nice friend I have. And when he got the house and the demigoddess for a wife, and he said, wow, what a nice friend I have. So whatever you get, take it as Krishna's prasadam. The bitter melon and the ice cream. Okay? Okay. We should end here, and next week we'll go on to chapter 13.